Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
We know we have a problem with racial bias in this country, but we also have a problem with color bias, and that's a different thing. From KERA in North Texas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Color bias is about assuming that some people are better than others by virtue of the darkness or lightness of their skin. And it's different from racism in a couple of ways. It can and does occur not just between different communities, but within communities of color, and even within individual families, where different skin tones mean one child is seen as more attractive than the other, and one person is seen by her peers as less authentically African-American or Latino or Asian than another based not on cultural identification but on physical appearance. My guest has thought a lot about this as the mother of three biracial children, one of whom has medium brown skin like her own that most people associate with African heritage, one of whom is the color of sand, as she writes, and one of whom is nearly as pale as her white father from Spain. Diving into her own family's experiences led her to look at how skin color affects other families and communities whose members display a range of different skin tones. Lori L. Tharps is Associate Professor of Journalism at Temple University. Her new book is called Same Family, Different Colors, Confronting Colorism in America's Diverse Families. Lori, welcome back to Think.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be back.
Will you give us your definition of colorism?
Sure. Basically, I think colorism is discrimination based on the color of someone's skin. Generally speaking, that discrimination comes against those with darker hues, but it can be against those with lighter hues, depending on the circumstances.
Why is it so hard to talk about?
You know, it's interesting. Before writing this book, I actually thought that talking about skin color differences would be easy to talk about, or at least easier than talking about race, for example, just because race is such a charged issue and color can be simple. I mean, it's something that we all see. We all experience color on a daily basis. But I think that the idea of really segregating ourselves into shades of skin color as opposed to, you know, these larger kind of racial categories, it makes people uncomfortable because it makes people feel that they're doing something wrong by noticing something as seemingly insignificant as the shade of somebody's skin as opposed to, again, their, you know, racial category.
Well, it's really interesting. You note that your own parents saw themselves differently. Your dad felt like a light-skinned black man. Your mom sort of defined herself as a dark-skinned black woman. How did those perceptions shape them?
It's interesting. I think that really I didn't know, because we never talked about this growing up, because I grew up in Wisconsin in a mostly white environment. So talking about colorism and skin color differences wasn't part of my experience. It wasn't until I started writing this book and interviewed my own parents that I found how much their own beliefs about themselves based on their skin color affected them growing up. For my mother, more than anything, because she was one of 10 sisters, where the range in skin colors was quite large. She had sisters who were very light, and she had sisters who were browner. She didn't have any sisters who were, you know, very, very dark, but she thought of herself as one of the darker of the sisters. But again, when there's 10 and you have such a large range,
right,
it wasn't the extreme. But I think it definitely played into her beliefs that she really had to succeed well academically. She was, you know, considered one of the smart sisters, and she really, you know, my mom has 3 degrees. You know, she's, you know, at age 50, went back to school and got her PhD and ended up her career as a college professor. So I do think that to a certain extent, the idea that she could not depend on beauty, she had to be known for her mind, comes from this idea that, you know, because she had a darker skin tone, that she wasn't going to be depending on, you know, she wasn't going to be in the beauty category. She was going to be in the brains category.
And was your father like, great, I'm in the beauty category?
No, my father, for him, and I think it's, and all of this is really dependent on gender plays a big role,
yeah,
in this as well. I mean, men aren't talking about beauty, but they are completely subjected to the same kinds of discrimination or, you know, different access based on the color of their skin. And for my father, it wasn't, you know, being – he definitely thought of himself as having lighter skin. And he mentioned that he – associate, his friends were all light, and the women that he dated as a, you know, in high school were light, and it was definitely something that he paid attention to. But that didn't, it didn't shield him from the discrimination that all black men felt growing up, you know, and the other, you know, he faced a lot of discrimination just being a black male in America, and having light skin didn't protect him from anything, or he didn't feel that way. And he was still, you know, he still felt the sting of racism many, many times. So for him, it wasn't a privilege, but it was definitely a category he saw himself fitting into, and one he maintained with the people he socialized with.
So we'll get to the historic weirdness of Europeans and their kind of sense that they were special because they had the palest skin of all. But why within communities of color would skin color, lighter skin color, be valued over darker skin color?
Well, each community has its own kind of unique pathway to fetishizing light skin. African Americans and Latinos share a similar experience of having a African Americans weren't colonized, but having you know, the history of slavery and being owned by a white majority, and Latinos also being colonized by white Europeans, by Spaniards, you know, you have a very similar sense of the power dynamic. The power structure was those in power were light-skinned or white. And so the desire to gain power and influence was commingled with this desire to be lighter, to be perceived as having power and wealth. All of that came with those who had lighter skin. And that's, again, because of the system of colonial power and white power in the United States in the time of slavery. So in that situation, in Asian American communities or Asian communities historically, the lightness wasn't about colonial power. It was about simply a class distinction. Those Asians who were wealthy enough to not have to work outdoors, their skin remained light. Those who were in the peasant class, as we say, who had to work out of doors had darker skin. And so the idea of dark skin became associated with a peasant class. And it wasn't just about those who had to work outdoors. Those characteristics were associated with the peasant class, like, you know, that they were poor, that they were uneducated, that they were uncivilized, and those ideas still remain. So all these different communities of color have come to this idea of lighter being more powerful, being more civilized, being more wealthy, all come from history, but they haven't been eradicated, even though we've gone beyond. I mean, we no longer live in an agrarian society where, you know, we have peasants and, you know, a social class that, you know, sits indoors all day to keep their skin light. And yet those ideas still remain. And it's because there's the legacy of these traditions. We still have in many Latino communities, you still have the lighter Latinos are the ones with more money and more power. Obviously, in the United States, we still have white America still has more power and more wealth than black America. So and even in the Asian American community here, we know that the East Asians tend to be I'm not 100%. That's not 100% accurate, because you also have Indian Americans who tend to have higher levels of education and wealth. But the perception is that those Asians who come from East Asia, Japanese, Korean, Chinese, do better than those Asians who come from Southeast Asia, for example, where people are darker. So perception still shows that perception and reality shows that those people in ethnic communities with lighter skin experience better education, have higher levels of education, and earn more professionally, live in better neighborhoods. So the reality shows us that people with lighter skin do better in society here in the United States and globally as well. It is a global phenomenon. But what I'm talking about, my research really focuses here in the United States.
I love that you point this out because it's something that I've thought about a lot, that in the U.S., we have used words like black and yellow and white and red, and now we say brown to describe race and skin tone. Except for brown, for some people, those colors are demonstrably incorrect for describing most people's skin color. Where do those terms come from?
It's really funny because they're so wrong. but they come from, really, they come from historical texts. They come from historical perceptions of what people, you know, really, in many, many cases, it's what Europeans decided to call other people and how they decided to label them. And we have just continued to use this language. There were, you know, in the, it's the ideas of the native people being red or the African people being black. These were terms that were really created to create divisions amongst humans. People weren't even, I mean, when the first Africans were brought to the United States, for example, the British weren't thinking of people as white and black. The division really wasn't initially, you know, a racial division. Race was a new concept that hadn't even been thought of by the British at that point. They were still dividing people by class. And the first Africans were not thought of as slaves. They were indentured servants, just like other Irish and other poor white Europeans who had, you know, come over, you know, selling themselves for passage to the New World. So these terms and these color names and color categories, you know, are more recent terms that people have used to define and divide people. Interestingly, in Asian culture, there was a classification system that they created that they did divide people by color. The system of division wasn't racial necessarily. It was by color. There was the black. There was the black race, the red race, the yellow race. But all of these, you know, all of these color terms, I think, are just easy ways to categorize. And in some cases, like the term black, it was a negative. It was definitely a negative term to demonize people because black was always associated with the negative, with the occult, with evil. And of course, that term has been reappropriated to be used as a term of pride with the Black Pride movement, you know, of the 50s and 60s.
It really is absurd the amount of emphasis we place on skin color.
It is. For certain parts of this writing of this book and doing the research, I really thought I should be writing a humor book because there's first this idea that we can divide and discriminate based on skin tone when it's such a subjective thing. There were people who I interviewed who I assumed I would be talking to them about their experiences being very light and how that was advantageous. And they would tell me that their experiences was just the opposite because they were so dark. And I'd be looking at them thinking, what are you talking about? And it's because they were compared to someone else in the family and that person was lighter than them. So they were dark. So it is a subjective thing.
We're speaking this hour with Lori L. Tharps. She's Associate Professor of Journalism at Temple University and author of the new book, Same Family, Different Colors, Confronting Colorism in America's Diverse Families. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send us a tweet at KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Lori L. Tharps, Associate Professor of Journalism at Temple University and author of the new book, Same Family, Different Colors, Confronting Colorism in America's Diverse Families. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Lori, this is really interesting. You met some people who have really struggled because they don't look like the race they identify with despite their family history. So you tell the story, for example, of a black woman who looked white enough to many people that she found herself, to spare everyone a lot of anguish, she would announce her blackness in white company, I guess, to keep people from saying racist things around her.
Yes. You know, it's really interesting because, again, as I said at the top of the hour, that for the most part, people assume colorism is discrimination against people with darker skin. And, you know, that's kind of a recognized definition of it. But I wanted to, you know, dig deeper into how skin color differences really manifest and, you know, what are the results of people looking different because based on their skin color. And there were plenty of people who had lighter skin who felt themselves to be completely isolated from not only their family, but their entire ethnic community. And the author and activist Asha Bandale used the term light skin isolation, which I thought was very fitting to describe this experience that many people of ethnic backgrounds described to me. And that is such a painful thing to not be recognized as either a member of your own family and or a member of your ethnic community. It's like feeling, you know, without a group, without a tribe, without a nation even. And so there are many people who have really light skin who end up, you know, creating very over, you know, they create other ways to define themselves. They pick up a stronger accent. They wear very ethnic clothing. They only associate with other people of their ethnic background. And it can become extremely, depressing, and it can really do a number on one's, you know, sense of self, identity, and confidence. Always having to kind of wear some kind of ethnic costume to prove to people just, you know, what ethnic group you belong to or what family you belong to. And that's kind of those were the unique stories I wanted to tell. I'm not writing the definitive story or the definitive, you know, book on colorism. I really wanted to get at the individual and unique stories that underscore how wide ranging the effects of skin color differences there really are.
It's a fascinating issue, not least because the choices we make about who to have kids with are changing. You know, not all skin color differences in families are attributable to parents of different races, but there sure are a lot more families like this in the U.S. today, including yours.
Yes, absolutely. When you have the multiracial community or interracial marriages are the fastest growing, you know, ethnic group, if you want to call them that, this is obviously a conversation that needs to be had. And from a personal perspective, this was one of the reasons I wanted to write this book, because I really wanted to have an excuse to go up to people with families that look like mine, which seem to be, you know, more and more common, and just ask them, like, do you get those stares? Do you get the funny comments? Has anybody ever not wanted to hand your child over at daycare because they didn't think you were their parent, your child's parent? All of these kind of daily microaggressions, if you will, that have happened to me as a parent with children who look very different. I wanted to really see how other people were handling those types of situations in their own families. And I do think that by bringing this conversation about colorism into the realm of the family, that more people could appreciate the story and understand the different dimensions of the issue. And that was something that I did learn, that even people who came from white families with no, you know, ethnic background whatsoever, there were many white people who told me when I would tell them what my book was about that they, you know, mom was Irish, dad was Italian, and sister took after the Irish parent and brother took after the Italian parent, blonde and fair versus kind of more olive toned and dark, and nobody would believe that they were siblings. And there were always people who had these types of stories. And again, I think if I spoke about colorism in a broader sense, I might not bring in so many people into the conversation. But when I brought it down to family, so many people could, you know, chime in and tell me about that experience that they had or that they're, you know, that they know about, because it's a very it's so much more common to be to have your world upended because of just the variation of skin, or even, I mean, sometimes it's the hair color or features in the family. But it's phenotype and not, again, racial differences.
How important is actual DNA, which, of course, hasn't even been available to us until incredibly recently? Like, what are the limits in any community of allowing somebody to identify with, you know, a particular culture because they feel tied to it, as opposed to, you know, that there are people who are adopted that may look like a certain race or ethnic group and not have had any exposure to it whatsoever?
Well, that's, you know, these are the questions that I want answers to. And this is why I wrote this book, because I don't have all the answers. I just want to provoke people to start thinking about these things. A good story to kind of, I'm going to tell you a story to answer your question. There was a woman that, I actually have a website that I'm developing where I am continuing these conversations and getting more people to tell me their stories, because everybody has one. But there was a woman who's in her 50s now. She was adopted. She was adopted by a white family, and the white family actually gave her back because they said she was not white. She was too dark.
Wow.
And they returned her. And a black family adopted her and raised her. And she's, again, in her 50s. And she just assumed she was a light-skinned black person. But there was no question to her black heritage, especially because she was rejected by a white family because they believed she was black. Turns out she went and got a DNA test, one of those, you know, spit in a tube and find out what your origins are. And she is 100% Caucasian. There is no black in her whatsoever. And so this woman is literally going through a midlife crisis right now because she doesn't know who she is. And this, again, when we talk about blackness or any other ethnic group, but your features, you're not dark enough to be quote unquote black, or, you know, Mexican, or, you know, Bangladeshi, as a woman I spoke to for the book. It really begs the question of how do we define our identities, our ethnic identities? What categories do we belong to? And is it based on something as subjective as color? These are the questions that I don't have the answers to. And even the people who I spoke to, the woman who was so light that she just allows people to believe that she is white, because it's too difficult to challenge people's perceptions because she's got very pale skin and very straight hair. But her mother is very much a black woman, and she was raised as a black child because her white father wasn't in the picture. But she cannot walk through the world, and she walks through the world and is treated as a white woman. So these identity questions are things that we have to talk about more openly, and we have to confront, because we are dealing with a culture that is becoming increasingly mixed. And again, the African-American community is a very mixed community, which is why you have a single nuclear family where the shades of skin can range really widely. You have Latinos that is not even a race, but you have a single Latino family because there is such a deep level of mixing in the Latino community that, again, the range of skin tones in a single family can be really large. And who's to say who gets to, you know, claim the label, the title of, you know, your ethnicity? This is why, personally, I believe that our conversations in this country about race are going to have to, I really think that we're going to have to move beyond race as the definer, because the categories that we have don't fit the phenotypes that we have. There's a lot of discussion about this, but it needs to get louder, and the conversation needs to be broader, and it needs to include all people, because everybody is impacted by whatever we call the categories that we put human beings in.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Dawn calling from Dallas. Hi, Dawn.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I just wanted to mention that I grew up in a community that seemed to value darker skin tones, and I heard one day in class a teacher, he was talking to a girl who was darker, had darker skin tones, and there was another one there who she was really light-skinned. And he said to the girl with the darker skin tones, he said, well, we're chocolate. And so he's like, she's not chocolate. She's milk. She has too much milk in her, but we're chocolate. And I thought, you know, that's just... And the one who was lighter, she looked, you know, really taken aback. And the one who had the darker skin tone, she looked, you know, like, oh, he's saying something good about me. But I just thought to myself, it was sad because we shouldn't be putting other people down or even elevating them because they're darker or they're lighter. But I think it can vary within the communities that you grow up in.
Dawn makes a really, I mean, she's bringing up a point that I mentioned in the book about, you know, the kind of overcompensation that a lot of parents do, believing that they're doing the right thing by uplifting their darker child at the expense, unfortunately, of their lighter child, if that's the case, because they know that out in the real world, darker skin is often demonized and people are discriminated against. But what happens then to the lighter child? The lighter child feels that there's something wrong with them. And I, you know, did interview a family that was the case for, actually a couple of people that was the case for, by mom and dad's, you know, uplifting the darker daughter. The lighter daughter grew to dislike her own skin tone. And that was something that I was concerned about in my own family. Like, if I uplift my darker son, is the lighter son going to feel badly about himself? These are the parenting conundrums we have, but we also see it out in the real world. And even sometimes with the best intentions of parents, when our children who are different colors go out into the world, they obviously have different experiences they'll be treated differently based on the color of their skin. So parents definitely have a lot of work to do to counterbalance the different experiences their children might have based on their differing skin tones.
I'm going to bring this up again for people who might just be joining the conversation, which I normally don't in an interview. But just for our audience, you are African American. Your husband is European. He's from Spain. Before you had kids, how much did you talk about what their skin color might be?
Well, we didn't really talk about what their skin color would be. I'm just such a silly romantic that. Who has always been in love with Spanish culture, but spent a lot of time in Spain and was kind of disappointed that I didn't find a lot of black culture in Spain, which I don't know why I actually thought I would. But I wrote a memoir called Kinky Gazpacho talking about the fact that I, you know, trying to find the black experience in Spain, which I did in some ways. But when it came time for us to have children, I really kept saying, I'm going to give birth to a Cuban or a Puerto Rican or a Dominican, because what do you get when you mix African and Spanish? I mean, you have entire, you know, populations of people who are exactly that mix. So I just assumed that my children would look like a Dominican person or a Cuban person or a Puerto Rican person, which, of course, what does a Puerto Rican look like? There's such a range of people, which just shows my own ignorance. But in my mind, I just assume that my child or my children would be some kind of perfect blend of kind of cafe au lait, you know, cafe con leche. It didn't seem like there would be any big surprise with my children, and still each one came out so different. Actually, they came out all looking exactly the same, but they evolved very, very differently.
And I know you think they are all perfect, but they don't look, their skin color is not the same. They don't necessarily look from a distance to people who don't know you like siblings.
Right. And it's funny because as a parent, you're not staring at your children all the time saying, wow, they're different colors. And for a very long time, I didn't see my sons. The age range is very large. I have a 12-year-old, a 15-year-old, and a 5-year-old. So for a long time, it was just the boys. And one's dark and one's light. And I still never looked at them that way. I didn't walk around thinking, wow, my kids are different colors. But the public would. They would just, you know, we would be walking around and they'd be like, oh, isn't that funny? You've got one black child and one white child. I guess that's perfect since there's a black parent and a white parent. Or they would just, you know, people would always say things and I still would deny it. I would say, I don't think they're that different. I really don't see it. And I think those are my parenting eyes. But after years and years and years, you know, you kind of get the idea that you're the one that doesn't see it. It's not because it's not there. I think there was a time when we were on the beach and I was looking at them from a distance and I said, oh, I guess they are different colors. Like, oh, from I guess when I'm not looking at them as my children, but just two kids on the, you know, out there at the beach, I kind of saw the difference. But I don't spend a lot of time thinking about it. Well, I do now because I wrote this book. But before that, it wasn't a constant. I didn't notice it. And so, I mean, I don't mean to say I was trying to be colorblind or anything, but it did take me a while to see what people were really commenting on all the time. I just thought people were just crazy, you know, always pointing it out. But it is true. And the thing is also that their hair texture is also very different. So they look different. I mean, they really look like they came from different places.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Alex calling from Dallas. Hi, Alex.
Hey, I would like to share my personal experience. Both my parents and, as far as we know, our generations backwards have been from Mexico, but they could not look anything alike. People often in the Mexican community and even especially, I guess, the American community would look at my mom and think she was South Asian or Middle Eastern, and then my father often would say, like, oh, is he like French or Spanish or Italian? So people with me, I'd never even fit into any cookie cutter, and they would just classify me as, okay, well, you can pass for white, but maybe he's from somewhere around the Mediterranean. Coincidentally, now being the father of two little girls, my wife is, you know, predominantly northern, northwestern European as far as, you know, the genealogy could prove, but my daughters, as far as I've been told, look like a spitting image of me. So it's now seeing the experience that my family had to go through with, you know, this is all the same gene pool, and look at all the shades we've gotten from, you know, what could look like the whitest little baby being held up by somebody who might fit into Bangladesh, and, you know, you could still see all the genetics of, like, well, they're clearly related. But
Alex, we've got to take a break right now. Will you hang on the line for us for just a minute?
Certainly.
All right, great. We are speaking this hour with Lori L. Tharps about her new book, Same Family, Different Colors, Confronting Colorism in America's Diverse Families. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Temple University Associate Professor of Journalism Lori L. Tharps. Her new book is called Same Family, Different Colors, Confronting Colorism in America's Diverse Families. Before the break, we were talking to Alex. And Alex, before I let you go, I just want to ask you this. As someone who is of Mexican descent, Mexican-American, does it bother you that people don't look at you and think you're Mexican?
Oh, yes. And from what I've noticed, it kind of comes from certain groups that it bothers me even more. You know, I've noticed that especially when it's non-Mexican Latinos, they're more quickly to assume I speak Spanish. But quite often from, you know, Mexican-Americans who are probably a couple generations removed, more often than not, they're like, oh, man, you don't really fit into our idea of what it's to be one of us. And then, you know, a lot of times from, I don't want to say the word Anglo, but, you know, you get the idea, they'll just kind of ask me for white and just move right along. And fortunately, I've never been discriminated against, but maybe that's just the privilege of passing.
Well, thanks very much for your call. Anything there that you want to sort of reach back to, Lori?
No, I think these are the stories that, you know, again, like I said, everybody has a story to tell when we talk about skin color differences in families. And I think that it's really telling this, you know, his last statement, you know, he had the privilege of passing. And it is a privilege in a lot of ways. But like I said before, it can also be very isolating.
It's interesting, this phrase passing, or this word passing, because it's never a term that works in the other direction, right? People are, unless you're like Rachel Dolezal, which is a whole different case. Typically, right. People don't say, I was able to pass for black, or I was able to pass for, you know, Asian or whatever. You don't hear white people saying that, which is weird.
Right. You don't hear it, but it is interesting. There is a lot of attempted cultural passing. I mean, there's a lot of people who adopt, you know, another culture, and we have, you know, mostly derogatory names for people like that. But I think that's one of the beautiful things about our culture is that, you know, you do have people who really feel more at home in a different ethnic group than the one they were born into. And, you know, that's when we get to people, you know, we talk about allies or just, you know, people who feel comfortable in that community, but don't try to pass, because passing implies, you know, kind of like getting over. There's a negative connotation to it. It's if you were, like, again, Rachel Dolezal is the, you know, unfortunate poster child for this, because it feels that she was being disingenuous and she was perhaps not understanding what it means to be black, but, you know, putting a costume of blackness on. But it is definitely something that if you do have lighter skin, there are levels of passing which you can move up into. And, you know, for, let's say, African-American people who maybe are lighter, they can pass for Latina, if not white, but maybe Latina. But there's many African-American people who, there's so much mixing in the African-American community. You do have African-Americans who do look like something other than what we consider to be African-American. But this is why the conversation has to start. Really, we really have to unpack these terms that don't work. You know, what is an African-American? You know, what is a white American? These categories that we've created do not allow for the nuance of what our real diverse heritage really is. There's a book called Mulatto America that came out in, I think, the late 90s that really spoke to the fact that we've always been a nation of mixed people. And this fallacy of believing that there were some kind of pure race somewhere in the United States, it's just that. It's a fallacy. And so when you have people who don't fit these, you know, all black or all white categories, it's like, oh my gosh, what do we call them? It's the problem is the categories we've created don't work for what we really are.
Well, that leads me to a tweet that we have from Dana, who asks, why does society pressure biracial people to choose which of their races they identify with when it is possible to identify with both?
Yeah, and again, this is it. It's all because of our twisted history.
Yeah.
This idea that there's an idea that the one drop rule that said that if you had any drop of black blood, that you were black, and therefore today, if you're mixed with black, for example, then you must be you must claim that category. I think that anybody who is mixed has a unique situation to they have a unique opportunity to define their own identity. And I think that looking at the mixed community for, there's a lot of activity about, discussing identity and claiming one's identity coming out of the mixed community. I mean, there's even mixed race studies in several universities now. And there, I think that's where people should be looking to get answers about, you know, where do we go from here? How does this conversation start when we talk about color and identity and ethnicity? Because if you are mixed, I mean, and it's not even like black and white is the only mix. You know, what about the kid who his mother is black and Mexican and their father is Chinese and German? What are they, right? I mean, this is the future we're confronting, and we are going to have to, I'm going to just say it right here live on the radio. We are going to have to retire our current racial categories because they will not work.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Tony in Dallas. Hi, Tony.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I am Native American and black. My dad was Native American. My mom was black. And the first seven is 12 kids. The first seven are light like my father. The last five, which I'm a part of, were darker like my mom, but we have the straightest hair. The others have like curly hair. And in my own family, with my husband and I, one child, the son is older. He has blonde hair, blue eyes, and the daughter has green eyes and dark brown hair. But I think we took charge in my family. My parents never let that be that distinction, so we don't feel very differently about it. And I've done that with my children, is to really, truly protect them from a lot of the images when they were very young around certain things. And they just don't think about it. I think they appreciate both the cultures and all of the cultures that are in and around us. But I think that having lived in and visited about 30 countries now, it is a predominant look in a society. I can go to some of the darkest places in the world, and people are bleaching skin, they're straightening hair, and they'll say to me when they look at my hair, oh, what kind of perm? And it's like God-given. You know, well, you have good hair. No, my hair is not good because of one way or another. You know, what do you mean good hair? Because it doesn't smoke, drink, stay out late and gamble? That kind of thing is what I will do around it, because people are so influenced now by the internet, television, images, magazines. It's all there.
Well, Tony, thank you so much for your call. You put a lot on the table, and I want to make sure that Lori has a chance to respond. She was talking with Deserved Pride about sort of helping her kids navigate this so it wouldn't be an issue. Maybe you can talk a little bit about how it seems in some ways you worried about your kids' response to this, and they've done okay with it.
Yeah, I like I said, one of the reasons I wrote the book was because I wanted to, you know, really find out if, you know, what is the right way to make sure your children don't grow up with, you know, divisions or hating their own skin color or hating each other because one is perceived to be privileged over the other. And I took a lot of notes from the people who I interviewed who seemed to really, like this woman, like Tony, who just called, who grew up maybe the darkest one in the family, but still had very positive sense of self and didn't even fixate on the fact that they could say it very clearly, but still didn't seem that it was defining them. I spoke to a really smart child psychologist in Chicago who basically said that it's a parent's responsibility to explain that difference is not negative. Hmm. If we normalized difference and really children notice differences, they're going to notice the difference between lighter and darker, red and blue. But we are the ones that lay on the meaning to what that difference is. And if we can teach children to appreciate that there's red flowers and yellow flowers and they're all flowers and they're all beautiful, but yes, there's a red one, there's a yellow one, they're different. But different doesn't mean they're wrong. If we could normalize difference for children, you know, it starts in the home, then they can grow up to believe that their darker skin or their lighter skin is nothing more than that. It's darker or lighter. And, you know, they keep on moving. The really negative images that we continue to see, when I say negative, I mean the fact that there's a lack of kind of beautiful, darker people. The people we see as beautiful that are put up by the media tend to be lighter skin. But on the same token, because we do have the internet now, because we can self-publish, there is a lot more opportunity to curate an experience for our children, whether we're teachers or our own children, to show them images of the spectrum of the human rainbow, if you will. And, you know, there are more dolls now. I mean, there are more books with images of different shades of skin. And don't get me wrong, they're not out there, you know, right on the front of Barnes & Noble or Toys R Us. You may have to only search on the internet for some of these things. But I think a very proactive parent can find a way to showcase the beautiful diversity of the human rainbow.
I realize I'm asking you to generalize in a major way here in this whole conversation where we've tried to avoid doing that. But I wonder what you've learned about grandparents, right? Maybe who have children who are in, you know, mixed race relationships and are likely to have grandchildren who do not look like them or their children.
Mm. That's a really great question. And it's one of those things where you really notice the difference. You know, if my you know, I have a friend who's Japanese, and her Japanese mother is out with her grandchild, who is half, he's only a quarter Japanese. So she really looks like a Japanese woman with a white child. You really notice these places, you really notice these instances where you have that, you know, same family, different color scenario. And I think it's really important for grandparents. And again, rather than in some cases, you might think, well, it's the white parent who needs to be prepared to have a darker child, a darker grandchild. But it's also the darker grandparent who's got to walk around with maybe a very light child who doesn't read as ethnic. And there's a whole lot of fear. If you imagine a black grandfather with his blonde hair, blue eyed grandchild, imagine what people might say if he's walking around town. There's a lot of suspicion and question with that. So all of these different scenarios come into play, and grandparents have to be clued in. First, they have to feel comfortable themselves with different colored people, but they also have to be clued into the kind of messaging we want to give to our children that, you know, we may look different, we may have different skin tones, but we're all family. And one of the things that I thought was really great was when I spoke to one family member where the range, they had four children and every child was a different shade of black. And they spent a lot of time bringing in images and stories and books about famous black people who were the whole gamut of the rainbow of blackness, if you will, so that, you know, really from the beginning, these children knew that black comes in different shades. And that kind of education can be going on with everybody. If it's the grandparents that need that education, if it's the children, but the family, if it happens, if it starts in the family unit, imagine where that knowledge then spreads out to, because we all start in a home somewhere. And if we take that, you know, newfound knowledge and that new perspective of appreciating difference, then the rest of the world will be, you know, influenced by this greater sense of understanding.
There are people who speculate that maybe within a couple of hundred years, humankind will be a sort of uniformly brown, racially ambiguous group of people, given, you know, global migration and intermarriage. Do you think, Lori, that we will still find a way to distinguish based on color and physical appearance?
Of course, because we won't all be the same brown. We'll be all ambiguous, but it'll be dark ambiguous, medium ambiguous, light ambiguous. And so that's why, again, it really, there's always going to be different colors on this planet. There has to be, because of, you know, the sun and what people need to protect their skin in terms of, you know, melanin production, which is all skin color really is. It's just a biological response to how close we live to the sun. So, again, it really comes down to people getting smarter about what skin color actually means, which, again, it's biology, and then being better at appreciating the fact that there is beauty in all different colors. We have been so brainwashed to believe that skin color connotes power, intelligence, wealth, when it doesn't. It does not at all. And so it's a unbrainwashing that needs to happen, and or just retraining and relearning. And all of us can do that. And we've seen it in other ways, in other kind of social movements. I think we can see it again.
Lori L. Tharps is Associate Professor of Journalism at Temple University and author of the new book, Same Family, Different Colors, Confronting Colorism in America's Diverse Families. Lori, it's always a pleasure. Thanks very much for making time for us today.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Eric Bright. Samantha Guzman is associate producer with help on the phones this hour from Javier Hiribet. And our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.